Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
And I think we will look back on the Britney Spears and Maria Sharapova era and really feel like we did some of these people dirty.
It is episode 47 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Caitlin Thompson, who is the co-founder and publisher of Racquet Magazine, a quarterly tennis magazine that is about much more than just tennis. We're going to get to the chat with Caitlin in a quick moment. Just before, we have to remind you to get in touch with the show. Email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm @GCooney93, or join the members WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast, which we are now going to get on with. Here's our conversation with Caitlin Thompson. Caitlin, thanks so much for doing the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You are co-founder and publisher of Racquet Magazine, at which point I assume your passion for tennis and writing intersect. So we might begin with the passion for tennis. Where did it first begin and how did it manifest itself?
Great question. I started playing tennis when I was a kid. I grew up in Montreal, which is not known as a tennis hotbed. You know, if anything, snowy grounds, 8 months out of the year meant a lot of skiing was in my childhood. But I used to go and visit my grandmother, who lived in the southwest of the states of the U.S., and she lived in Arizona. My parents were classical musicians. They used to go on tour every summer for months at a time. They would drop me off in Arizona, and I would just be totally ensconced in my grandmother's world. And she took up tennis as sort of a retirement, a retirement activity. She was a nurse, Black Irish, as we say here in the States, from a little fishing village in the north of Ireland called Kilkeel. And she took up tennis and got really into it and got me really into it. So it became this sort of sacred thing that we did together really early in the morning, every day during the summer. And I just associated it with such happy, happy memories. And later on, way later, when I got good at it, it wasn't unrelated to the fact that I found it so joyous, when I was a child. And it's still something I take a lot of joy from. I've actually just come back from having a hit this morning, even though it's a little bit raining here in New York. So I try to play as often as I can. I love tennis with a very deep passion, as you can probably tell.
Yeah. How good did you get?
I got decently good. I was sort of sniffing at the edges of a professional career, which is not to say that I was close. Just I saw how much skill and dedication it took. I got to what we call a Division I level, which means I got a free college education here in the States, and I played a few professional tournaments, although calling them professional tournaments would really be a little bit of a mischaracterization. Technically, you earned money by playing these tournaments, but, you know, I think it was in the sum of under $100 or $200. So nothing that was, you know, comparable to Wimbledon, certainly. But I got to a place that was good enough to earn a free education, which for me was phenomenal. And as it happens, I studied magazine journalism. So I was able to sort of meld my love of tennis that had been a lifelong passion and a tennis career, really, up until I was, 22 or so, with a very, very passionate sort of love of storytelling and magazine journalism when we launched Racquet. I guess it was about 4 years ago. So it felt like things really kind of came together in a sort of unexpected and magical way, because prior to launching Racquet, I had been a political journalist for a lot of years. So Racquet really allowed me to take those two really strong passions of mine and combine them into one.
Yeah, just briefly on your playing career, Did you have any brushes with greatness on their trajectory upwards?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, when I was 17 or so, I played a girl called Alexandra Stevenson. Alexandra Stevenson wasn't somebody you might remember, because she made a semifinal of Wimbledon, I guess it was in the early 2000s, kind of out of nowhere. She was 6'4", or so she's enormous. And the rumor was, later confirmed, that a very famous basketball player known as Dr. J, Julius Erving, was her father, which was confirmed. And I played her at age 17. And I remember, I think we would last it on the court maybe 30 minutes, 35 minutes. You know, it was not a competitive match by any means. I think if anything, she was probably a little bit bored. But just seeing that this girl was going to go on and have not exactly a tremendous professional career, but have a great run at one tournament and kind of linger in the top 100, and just noting how far the two of us were apart was sort of an early and honestly thankful indication that maybe my future did not lie in playing professional sports. Sometimes it's a bit of a gift. Players I know who got closer have a little bit more of a gut-wrenching experience with it because they have a lot of questions like, oh, I could have been, or what if I had trained a little harder? Or what if I had gotten a little luckier in a draw? I have no such questions. Let's just put it that way.
I totally agree with that. And I am even more fortunate than you, Caitlin, in the sense like any pretensions I had of any kind of athletic career were bet out of me by the age of maybe 7 or 8. So I got all of that bother out of the way before I hit puberty. It was pretty ideal timing. So like before we get to Racket Magazine, talk to us a little bit about politics. You did obviously work in politics for a little bit. Where did you work and what kind of things did you work on?
I covered presidential elections. So my first job here in the States was, I lived overseas for a little while. I lived in Spain and I lived in China working as a journalist. And then when I came back to the States, I worked here first on a news program called The News Hour, which is a sort of nightly news program here on our public television. Then I worked at the Washington Post for a few years in DC, covering the political race in 2004 and then 2008 when Barack Obama was running for the first time. And then I moved up here to New York, where I still remain, to work for Time Magazine and later WNYC, which is our public radio station. And so I covered political cycles. It all in sum ended up being, let's see, 04, 08. And 12-3 presidential campaign cycles. And that was enough to make me completely disillusioned with politics. Not completely. Obviously, it's very important to stay politically engaged, especially when, well, both of our countries are in the middle of a very interesting inner dialogue about who we want to be and who we want there with us. But I got to the point where I felt like I wasn't telling the kinds of stories I wanted to. In fact, politics ended up being a little bit more covered like a sport. And ironically, when I started working on Racket with my partner, David, who is my co-founder, a fellow by the name of David Schaftel, he and I made really sure that we didn't want to cover tennis like a sport. We wanted to cover it like it was an esoteric subject worthy of deep exploration. And ironically, it took talking about sports and making our magazine, which I think is about tennis to a degree, but it's really about life and geopolitics and travel and the economic fractures around the world and the inner life of a lot of these athletes, amateur or professional, that we ended up talking about stuff that was a little bit more real than the years I spent talking about politics.
That's interesting. We had Brian Curtis of The Ringer on this show many moons ago, and he talked about how presidential debates are kind of a match between like a boxing prize fight and ESPN's Around the Horn now. It sounds like you also got out in time before the 2016 election.
Oh God, I'm so glad I missed that one. That one would have wrecked me just because not to delve into politics too much, but a writer I really admire, a guy called Matt Taibbi, who writes a lot for Rolling Stone, wrote a very seminal piece for Rolling Stone on the campaign trail in March of 2016, when Trump's campaign was still being treated and talked about like a joke, because the political journalistic apparatus we have, and Brian is completely right, has absolutely no semblance of partiality towards facts. They're partial towards entertainment. And so you have a candidate for the first time in a long time who understands that in some intrinsic way. And the political establishment had no idea what to do with it and couldn't turn it off. And so this is how we got where we are. And so Matt Taibbi, for the first time, really described how much we had let our journalistic sort of culture devolve and our political situation becomes so precarious that any, and I'm quoting almost directly from the piece, any two-bit con man with balls big enough could walk right in the front door of the White House. And that's what happened. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh my God, this is what's going to happen. And like Cassandra, I was doomed to tell the truth and have no one believe me. So I felt really very conflicted about the 2016 election. But honestly, thank God I had an excuse not to watch cable television and not be immersed in it from a sort of storytelling perspective. Because if I had had to deal with that every day, I would have, I don't know, I think I would have collapsed into despair.
Yeah, by that stage, you're in the relative haven of Racket Magazine. Now, I do want to ask, like, launching a magazine in today's world, today's publishing world, seems like a pretty major challenge. What made you go for it and what's made it successful?
Those are two related questions, so I'm glad you asked, because we were treated like, I don't want to say total pariahs, but we were treated like, oh, these naive children, do they not know about the magazine industry? Have they not heard? Do they not know sort of that they're going to be walking into a buzzsaw? And we wagered, ultimately successfully, I would add, that two things were unique about what we were aiming to create. First of all, my partner David and I saw it in its whole unfettered form way before anything existed out in the world. And by it, I mean Racket Magazine, the print quarterly, the publication of books, which just happened over the summer. We can get to that. You know, the film projects, the podcasts, the creative agency work we're able to do with brands. We saw the entirety of the media company as it was designed to be, because we had been friends for a decade and we had had an ongoing dialogue, not only about tennis, but also really about media and what kind of business models were succeeding and how basically if you put content on the internet, which was what every other news organization was doing for free, I would add, then you're getting a ton of visitors and a ton of users, but possibly not a very engaged audience that's going to follow you anywhere. So there was a lot of media theory that went into it, and we had an incredible model because we ripped off 100%. Monocle, for people who don't know, is Tyler Brulé's sort of business media company. I kind of loosely use the term business, but it's a print magazine, it's a podcast, it's a brand consulting agency, it's an event series, and it's a sort of lifestyle publishing and e-commerce juggernaut. And the readership of that magazine and the people who listen to the podcasts and go to the events are relatively small compared to other media companies, but they're devoted and Monocle has a direct relationship to them. And so we saw this and said, huh, this works. He's not reaching a ton of people, but the right people, and they're willing to pay directly and subscribe to the magazine or buy the $100,000, you know, the $500 Japanese umbrella off of the Monocle website. So we had that part of it. But more importantly, for the purposes of our chat today, we saw tennis as really lacking a narrative, journalistic, storytelling entity, which is to say that there are not some amazing sports writers, journalists, thinkers, filmmakers, creators, commentators who touch tennis. It was just more, there wasn't any longer a home that had that as its sort of central mission, its central operating sort of principle. And Tennis Magazine, which here in the States used to be a very, very good magazine, which was owned by the New York Times Company, was a very robust journalistic and storytelling sort of medium when I was growing up, when David and I were growing up. And we remember how good it was. And for various reasons that are kind of boring to discuss, it fell into like basically becoming, you know, liner of bird cages. So we felt like we had a bit of a blue sky to kind of throw our weight around, which is, I'm cautious to say the American landscape was wide open because there is a little bit more conversation and media coverage of tennis outside of the States. But here in the States, the world we were looking at was no tennis storytelling plus a model in a Monocle sort of container that we knew would be, if not successful, then have a very good chance. And that's kind of all we needed.
Mm. Did you have, you must have had a like an ideal piece in mind, the kind of tennis piece that you would want to publish at Racket Magazine when it started?
We had a, and this is the benefit of friendship, because I had worked with David, I had played tennis with David, you know, almost on a daily basis. And we had this long friendship that allowed us to share images, stories, books, inspiration. And we did that before we knew even what we were going to do together as a project. We just liked it because we were kind of creating a shared language without overtly knowing it. And we did it over a decade because it was essentially 10 years between when we met and became friends and ultimately when we launched the magazine. One or two of the pieces that were really, really seminal for us were some of the writing of David Foster Wallace. That's kind of a no-brainer. anybody who's into tennis and has any kind of a cultural or sort of narrative lens on it cannot help but in some way, shape, or form be in dialogue with David Foster Wallace. Either they hate him or they relate to him or they love him, but in no way can you really ignore him. So David Foster Wallace is an easy one just because he had carved out in writing, whether it was in GQ or the New York Times Magazine or in, you know, the collections of anthologies he ended up publishing prior to his death, obviously, I should note. He was a sort of a juggernaut in this tennis culture space. And then occasional pieces. You mentioned The Ringer a little bit ago. Obviously, The Ringer's forebear, Grantland, which was an ESPN publication, which essentially employed almost 100% overlap with The Ringer. You know, they would occasionally talk about tennis. And so we had these great examples of a few really, really amazing literary sort of explorations of the game. And again, they were fantastic. They existed before ours did, but there weren't enough of them and they weren't in one place. And so we thought, we could gather them together, commission pieces like this, and use a few existent sort of narrative long form pieces to kind of build out our universe. And so those were very top of mind when we started making the first issue.
David Foster Wallace was the name that jumped into my head as well. He wrote one of the pieces that you've submitted to us today. I had read a couple. I've obviously read Roger Federer as a religious experience because it describes Federer's liquid whip of a forehand, which is my favorite line of description in sport ever. There's also an amazing one that I recommend listeners check out called, is it Tracy Austin Broke My Heart or something, which is fantastic because he's totally fascinated by Tracy Austin. She should have an amazing life story to tell. She's like the youngest female champion of the US Open ever, then had her career cut short in a car crash, and he then picks up her autobiography and is totally bored by how banal it is. It's so good. But the one that you submitted to us today is in the collection A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. It's called Derivative Sport in Tornado Alley. Can you maybe explain to us, Caitlin, what this is about?
Yes. And I'm going to reference those other two pieces you mentioned. So I really do encourage any listener to read them. Most of them are on the internet if you kind of search a little bit deliberately, even though a lot of the links are from the 90s or early 2000s. The tennis is derivative sport in Tornado Alley is, to me, one of David Foster Wallace's best tennis pieces, even though he has a pretty substantial body of work about tennis. And the reasons I think this is true require me to explain a little bit about what I think David Foster Wallace is doing when he talks about tennis. And I think the famous pieces that he very sort of overtly breaks down and explains his view on the Tracy Austins of the world, Andre Agassi, Pete Sampras, for many people, the Roger Federer as a religious experience in the New York Times was essentially the seminal piece of tennis writing at all. I find these pieces very, very good, and they're very good as jumping off points, but the piece that you and I are talking about now is essentially about his youth growing up in the Midwest in a windy, unforgiving, not exactly a tennis hotbed, but as a very competitive junior tennis player. And there's one piece in this sort of, it's a Bildungsroman, right? It's a coming of age. There's a lot about this piece that reminds me in not necessarily a good way, but a sort of a catcher in the rye, real adolescent reflection theme. And I think the part that stands out to me the most, that rings the most true, is he in confronting his limitations of his tennis ability, and like we were just talking about, they can come at different ages for different people, but I think most of us who play sport in some way as kids have the thought occur to us at some point that what if I were really good at this? What if I were the best in the world? And then the accompanying devastating thought that when you realize you're not. And this is the piece where he really explores what he calls adult sadness. This idea that the world doesn't owe you something, this idea that the world isn't necessarily going to line up to make all of your dreams come true. And it's really this like sort of universal shedding of the solipsism of youth. And not to get too highfalutin about it, but it's really interesting to me because to me it's one of his truer essays because it's so self-reflective. I was invited to talk about David Foster Wallace at length, an author I generally kind of have some problems with, on my friend's podcast. Her name is Andrea Petkovic, and she's an accomplished professional tennis player. She's won, I think, 7 or 8 titles on the WTA Tour, made a top 10 appearance in the early 2011-2012 season. She is a reader and invited me, and loves David Foster Wallace. She invited me to come on her podcast, which is a book club podcast, and talk about David Foster Wallace. And we had this very in-depth conversation about him and how he is so incredible at explaining the sport of tennis, but how he has real shortcomings when it comes to sort of holding himself accountable. And when he talks about the pros and when he talks about Tracy Austin, or when he famously talks about another player called Michael Joyce, who's a journeyman player who never quite breaks through. And in this piece, String Theory, David Foster Wallace talks about how hard it is to be a professional tennis player, because you can be the 100th best in the world, and as Michael Joyce is, still sort of struggling week in, week out. Now, when he talks about pro athletes, David Foster Wallace has an unaccounted for jealousy that I think clouds his ability to write about them really, really truthfully. Tracy Austin, he slags because he thinks she should be sadder about not having made it. And as a writer, he's exquisite, but he also is extremely ungenerous to her in a way that I actually don't like. But in this piece, and the reason I'm bringing up these other pieces is because this piece, to me, is David Foster Wallace at his best, really plumbing the depths of what sport means to an individual kid, growing up with these notions of grandeur and these notions of what your world and your life is going to become, and then grappling very, very quickly and very devastatingly with the truth of existence. And it's beautiful writing. It's lyrical writing. It writes about the sport and the angles and the difficulty in a way that I think is relatable to anybody, even people who haven't played. But the real part of the piece that I love is just him basically talking about the unbearable lightness of being, you know, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, he did. He had a very pessimistic view of life. At times, I have to say, there's a line in it. I think there's a long essay he did about John McCain, I think, and I think that's it. There's a line in it that it goes something like, "It's uniquely American to die wondering if you ever loved anything but yourself." I was like, "Oh God."
Yeah, listen, this guy killed himself.
Yeah,
that's sort of the elephant in the room a little bit when you talk about David Foster Wallace.
And I mean, like, maybe I'm imbuing this with too much significance, but you can see it. You can see the germs of it in this piece when he talks about adult sadness. Like, just to bring listeners aware, if you haven't read it, like, between the ages of 12 and 14, he was an extremely good young tennis player because, according to his own account, he could master the conditions, the very windy conditions he played in the Midwest. But then as soon as, you know, tennis got competitive and moved to gorgeous green grass on the coast, he couldn't compete anymore. And it's just the fit, and also the fact that the other kids hit puberty before him, you know, and they got larger and faster and stronger much quicker than him and left him behind. That's essentially the story here, but obviously it's teased out in a far more interesting and far more lyrical way.
I think what you just hit on, which is a really interesting sort of point, and you did a better job of summarizing the piece than I did, but it at once makes you understand how hard tennis is and how beautiful it is. And also, you know, like we were talking about, that adult sadness of not sort of understanding that not necessarily, you know, the world is going to work out as you want it to. I also think, and this is generally about David Foster Wallace, who has an entirety of collected works about tennis specifically in a collection that was just released, I think, last year called String Theory, which includes this essay among the other ones that I referenced. And what I don't like about him, which ironically isn't, I think, a good way to read him, is to allow yourself to understand why he feels so pessimistic, but also, if you can, try to remember that most of us work through this and actually end up better off on the other side, because once we realize that the universe doesn't owe us anything, you're free. And I think when you talk to a lot of these athletes, or really self-involved writers, which is what David Foster was, for better or for worse, mostly for better, you see how sometimes they can't separate themselves from divine providence and it doesn't feel like a choice.
But it's also this is something that's in the Tracy Austin essay. So one of his problems with Tracy Austin is the fact that she can live this incredibly dramatic and interesting athletic life and not be able to remember or describe it at the end. And his theory toward the end is almost like, he doesn't use the phrase, but athletes are in a kind of a flow state to achieve these great things on course. So they're there's absolutely no self-awareness in what they do. And they're just almost, it's like the way athletes will talk about, oh, you see things almost in slow motion. It's just they act before they have to think, kind of thing. Whereas David Foster Wallace was all self-awareness. So that goes back to the idea of projecting, you know, he's projecting the Tracy Austin essay. I think he's projecting in a different way in the same essay.
100%. I also think when he talks about Michael Joyce and Tracy Austin, he can't reconcile the fact that they're so good at this sport, but they don't appreciate how good they are at this sport. And it's coming from a place of jealousy because he wishes he could be what they are. And maybe that also means unburdened by the self-awareness that it takes to understand. And I actually think we haven't discussed this book yet, but it's pretty seminal reading in, I would argue, any fan of any sport, which is Andre Agassi's autobiography called Open. And what's so notable about it, and again, he had a very good ghostwriter, J.R. Moringer, but even still, it required a level of self-awareness from Agassi to talk about how being exceptional feels, because by definition, you can't think to yourself, okay, I've got triple championship point and I'm about to hit an ace. Isn't this an amazing moment? Don't I have an amazing serve? What an incredible thing it would be if I were to win the next point. No, of course not. That would take you out of the moment. It would make you probably unable to execute in your body what you would need to do to win that point. So you can't simultaneously be in your head and in your body. And Andre Agassi's book, kind of similar to some of the best parts of these David Foster Wallace essays, get into that space, which I find endlessly fascinating, which is, can you both be exceptional at something, but then also understand what that exceptionalism is and can be? It's almost an impossible state to understand both things at the same time.
Yeah, David Foster Wallace, he may, like you say, he might not like him, or he may infuriate you, but all those essays are so worth reading, just in terms of how, like, he describes tennis. Like, I've underlined this bit, I've never seen anyone describe sport like this before. Unless you're one of those rare mutant virtuosos of row fours, you'll find that competitive tennis requires geometric thinking, the ability to calculate not merely your own angles, but the angles of response to your angles. Because the expansion of response possibilities is quadratic, you're required to think N shots ahead, where N is a hyperbolic function limited by the sine of opponent's talent and the cosine of the number of shots in the rally so far, roughly. I was good at this.
It's three-dimensional chess, and I think he does an excellent job of explaining just how difficult the sport is. There's one of my favorite anecdotes about, and I think it was in David Foster Wallace's piece about the US Open, although I could be mistaken, and it was Andre Agassi. At one point, they go to a batting cage. American baseball players often go to batting cages to practice hitting. And Andre Agassi finds himself in a batting cage where you're regularly getting 90 to 100 mile an hour fastballs. And it's uncommon to hit all of these well. As a matter of fact, usually you swing and miss, right? Andre Agassi was hitting every single one as a line drive and then got bored and started running towards the machine, trying to aim where he would hit the ball. And again, this is with a bat, a 90 to 100 mile an hour fastball. And I truly don't think, having played tennis as well as a lot of other sports, that the layperson grasps quite how difficult and complex it is. And I think it's very, very hard to capture it on television because of the angles that both require holding the entire court in the screen, but also being able to show a little bit of the speed and angle, which is why I encourage anyone at any level, go and watch tennis locally. Doesn't have to be pro. Find a good college team or a good club team. When you watch it up close, you start to appreciate just how hard it is. I mean, obviously playing it is also really good at teaching you that. But I love the fact that David Foster Wallace regularly, probably better than anyone else I've ever read, in every single essay, finds a new way or a new description or a new concept. You just described one that was mathematical. the one you started at with Roger Federer's liquid forehand movements, there are very few people who are as committed as David Foster Wallace to describing the game to outsiders or lay people as he is. And with the many, 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 many thousands of words he spilled on trying to do this, one of them will connect with any reader. I am confident. I'm not sure if every single one works for every person, but I think, as you said, love him or hate him, and I find myself doing both simultaneously sometimes, he is worth reading if you're a fan of any sport, certainly tennis. And I think he does it a lot of justice because he's so thoughtful about explaining it to people who haven't played it or watched it very closely.
Look at how difficult this is. It's kind of what he does with tennis, but I think that's kind of a subtext to all of his writing. Even like Infinite Jest kind of does exist purely as a showcase of how hard reading should be.
it's the Ulysses of the millennial age.
We'll move on to a piece that you did get published in Racquet magazine by Sarah Nicole Prickett called "The Reselling of Maria Sharapova." Tell us more.
Certainly a more accessible piece. So the reason I wanted to talk about this piece a little bit is it's one of the few Racquet pieces available to read online. We don't make a ton of our work available online because, kind of like we were talking about, we think that our writers, illustrators, photographers, and designers have done such a great job making a special thing that you can get four times a year that it's worth paying for. However, given the realities of the world and the fact that we want to make some of it accessible, we publish occasional pieces online. And this is one of them that we commissioned from a writer who mostly does celebrity profiles and write-arounds, which, I think most people are probably familiar with the term write-around, which is when you don't get access to the star or protagonist, but you have to kind of write around their lack of interview. And I think in the sports context, write-arounds are usually more, I don't want to say more accurate, but I think that they get to a more essential truth a lot of the time, because as you just noted, athletes are trained now more than ever to be banal, not probing. And if anything, they have learned either through their handlers or through brushes with the press that when they attempt to say something sort of off kilter or off piste, they're usually punished for it. So self-awareness, a lyrical description of oneself, and real attempts to connect with a journalist are not things that athletes, I think, prioritize these days. And so write-arounds usually end up being, I think, closer to some kind of essential truth. And we wanted to take this opportunity when Maria Sharapova was coming off of essentially a year-long drug ban to kind of assess her, what could be in her interior, right? She's famously tight-lipped. She's famously extremely controlled. She has an interesting biography coming to the States as a very young kid with no money and essentially being built from the ground up sort of as a prototype of what a tennis prodigy can and should be, which is be marketable by all brands, win a bunch of Grand Slams, make a ton of money, and still remain at the heart of it very much a cipher. And we thought that was an interesting opportunity to sort of take what was a rare misstep from her, which is missing this sort of drug ban update, getting caught with the banned substance and having sort of a moment of self-reflection, which was not common for her or certainly not something that jibed with her. And again, I can't stress this enough. She was the highest paid female athlete in any sport for most of the years she competed, despite the fact that she had a losing record against Serena Williams. There are far more decorated players, but she was seen as this perfect branding partner. The brands that she was representing are myriad. And the reason I think Sarah Nicole Prickett's piece is so good is she starts to really contextualize Maria Sharapova, not even as a tennis player, but just as a celebrity, as an empty vessel, as a brand, and somebody who maybe didn't ever develop a personality because she understood at some cellular level that her whole life was about being sold with brands attached. And to develop an internal viewpoint personality, idea, body of thought would be not useful to that endeavor. And so now she's got a ton of money, but almost nothing in terms of a person to show for it. And Sarah, who famously started one of my favorite magazines of all time called Adult Magazine, which is sort of this cult thing that's available. I think you can buy back issues on, you know, eBay. But she was somebody who really had no problem using her imagination and putting Maria into the sort of commercialized lens that she has solely existed in and really kind of exploring that. And for that reason, I thought she was a great person to talk about this piece. But you read it. Tell me what you thought.
I thought it was... I felt slightly sorry for Maria Sharapova near the end because it did linger on the fact that she kept getting beaten by Serena Williams. And I felt that maybe because, like, I've never paid Maria Sharapova too close. I haven't paid too much close attention to her over the last, in her whole career, really. I've always kind of seen her more as a brand than as a tennis player. And I think this readjusted my focus on that. I think maybe she cares more about losing to Serena than perhaps I had given her credit for. Do you agree with that?
It's hard to know, but probably. I mean, I think that is what made her such a fascinating subject to us, is the fact that she could be anything and you can interpret her so many ways. And one of my favorite thinkers, who I hope we get to talk about a little bit, Werner Herzog, you know, the filmmaker, he's an artist, he's an author, he's an actor. He talks a lot about this concept of ecstatic truth. And even if something is not actually true or the facts don't line up, art is about attempting to tell a greater truth. And I don't want to pump this piece up too much, although it did win some awards. But what we are attempting to do, and what I find so fascinating with the idea of running a literary magazine and why Sarah is such a good fit for us, and why this is maybe a really good approach to writing about athletes, is if you do a write around, if you don't get access, if you don't have to use the prepackaged quotes that come from directly from an athlete or their team, you are free to interpret, as long as you are forthright about the fact that this is an interpretation, but I hope that in my interpretation, I am attempting to really grapple with who this person could be and hope to get to some kind of greater ecstatic truth about that person. And I think just as we were talking about with David Foster Wallace and how hard it is for athletes to describe themselves and their own achievements, this approach, which we didn't invent, if anything, The Ringer, Grantland, you know, Gay Talese with Frank Sinatra Has a Cold in Esquire magazine in the 1950s, created the prototype of the right around. But sometimes the words that come out of the subject's mouth are not as truthful as what a really good writer operating at their most observant self can achieve. And it's my hope, and I don't know Maria Sharapova, but it's my hope that we actually did her a bit of a service by trying to see her, really see her in this piece. And it's my hope that whenever we talk about an athlete, we do the same thing, because I think people at the end of the day deserve to be seen, whether that's flattering or not. That to me is more satisfying than writing a piece that might, you know, pump their tires but not actually get to anything truthful.
I'll ask you, what is the ecstatic truth then about Maria Sharapova? Like, I always saw her as a brand. Even like the Sharapova stuff felt kind of meta, to be honest. It was almost like, look, even the branding can be fun, like this is all good. Then I kind of felt kind of sorry for her, that she was almost exploited. She's a brand, but she's, you know, someone else decided she was brand. You know, like the piece quotes the descriptions of her when she first burst on the scene, and even how the Wimbledon final against Serena, the one that she won, was described. It was all a little bit leery. It was all a little bit like how a lot of people are reassessing how they talked about Britney Spears, if that makes sense.
Completely. I think you said it better than I could have. That is how I feel about Maria.
Then what do you, like... And actually, the one other great line in this piece is when she tested positive for meldonium. No one knew meldonium beforehand. And the inference was, wow, Maria can even sell the idea of meldonium.
Exactly.
She's retired now. What's her legacy? Where does she stand as we look back on her place in tennis history?
I mean, I think that's one of the problems, right? I think the fact that Maria Sharapova made her legacy is mostly that she was the highest paid female athlete for a number of years. Look, she won 5 Grand Slams. She won one on every surface and the French Open twice. So kudos to her. That's an incredible achievement in and of itself. But I think her, much like Britney Spears, and I love that you made that comparison because I think that they are very, very similar. We have, I wouldn't say stopped, but we have started to move beyond just the complete commodification of human beings as shills for products, certainly athletes. And I think we will look back on the Britney Spears and Maria Sharapova era and really feel like we did some of these people dirty, as we like to say here in the States, right?
And it's already happening. And I think the athletes are doing it themselves because the counterpoint is Sharapova in this piece talks about like, I can't make a political comment at all. Like she's talking about the discrimination against gays in Russia to say, time will tell, you know. I think she said something nice about Putin and then she said some of my best friends are gay. I'm paraphrasing there, but that's the essential element of what she said.
You hear the tension, and in her case, the tension is not between what political viewpoint do I espouse, but the tension is who can I be? Who am I allowed to be? Because my entire existence, my 16th birthday was sponsored by Motorola. How many authentic moments has this woman had in her life? Even winning, achieving something insane about, by any measure of sport, how measured or restrained was that because she knew she had to put it into the context of what product was going to be sold, you know? And I think ultimately her story, or at least the way that I see it and why I think this piece is so successful is because I hope her life is not a tragedy, but I suspect it is. And Sarah Nicole Prickett with this piece has done, I think, a beautiful job of making the case that if anything, we should be a little more maybe sympathetic or maybe try to look for the humanity in there that we haven't allowed this person to have because she was so good at doing this very superficial thing, which is selling products, chief among them herself, so well.
Do you suspect that she's not very happy? Is that an unfair question to ask?
It's interesting. I've gotten to know a lot of retired professional tennis players. And maybe this is true of all retired athletes. I just happen to know the tennis players. But I think that there's a real search for meaning when you go from an extremely linear, extremely goal-oriented, and extremely sort of peripatetic existence where all you're doing week by week is resetting. New place, same hotel, same routine, match play, same goal, win as much as you can, move on to the next one. When you do that for years and you don't take a minute and say, huh, I'm in St. Petersburg this week. Maybe I'll go to the museum. Maybe I'll go find a cafe. Now I'm in Miami. What a fun experience this could be to go to, you know, Little Havana and have some Cuban sandwiches. They're not doing that by and large. The ones I've met are really searching for meaning when they leave the tour because meaning isn't something they even considered. And now that their bodies are older and broken and they can't do what they know how to do, which is win tennis matches anymore, there's a real, I think, dearth of meaning to their lives. And the ones I've seen who've made that transition the best either have sort of families, which is not to say that families are a good solution for everyone, and God knows raising children is not easy, I can attest to that personally, but more they have a really hard time finding something to fill that void because it hasn't been sort of, they haven't enjoyed it enough and they haven't allowed it to sort of become part of their personality for the reasons we were talking about earlier. If they realized how hard what they were doing was and maybe enjoyed it a little bit, they probably wouldn't be able to do it for very long. So it's a very weird and endlessly fascinating juxtaposition that I find, you know, and I this will not be our last piece about a conflicted professional athlete, I can tell you that, but it's certainly a trope that I find really sort of endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, I'm beginning to think like celebrity is kind of cruel, and the way I'm going to go into this is like, so the 30 of your picks doesn't have tennis involved at all. It's Sadie Smith's 2016 essay Fences, a Brexit Diary. But So this is in a collection. She was originally, I think, in the New York Review of Books, but it's in a collection called Feel Free. And also in this collection is an essay by Justin Bieber. Now, I don't know if you've read that, but it is amazing because it talks, and I think this is possibly relevant to the Sharapova thing, because it talks about celebrity as a kind of a cruel thing. She talks, I can't remember the name of the philosopher, so I'm going to guess it's Socrates, but it may be wrong, so I'm sorry, listener. But she talks about, uses Socrates to explain relationships between people. So it's an I-it relationship or an I-they relationship. So an I-it relationship is just almost like you to an inanimate object, not quite inanimate object, but just a strictly professional relationship with absolutely no depth of meaning at all. It's like the person that gives you coffee in the morning, person at the door, person in a meeting, whatever. Whereas I-thou relationships are like deep personal relationships in which there's a dialogue. It's not you talking to it, it's I-thou, you're talking to each other. And the example she gives is Justin Bieber lives all of his life in just I-it relationships, because everyone meets him just to get a photo with him. Like, it's all, he's just kind of an inanimate object to everyone. And he doesn't exist as a full person. He just exists as a kind of, as the selfie that someone wants to get. And there's a gorgeous line about it in the sense that Justin Bieber lives his life in pure monologue, which I really liked, in terms of just how, it's just such a really good and interesting way of exploring how celebrity and celebrity athletes are objectified.
100%. I think you could not have picked a more relevant example about what I like about Zadie Smith's writing, which is why I find her endlessly inspiring, and also her her understanding of sort of globalism, which we'll set aside for now, just because I think what you bring up is a little bit more relevant from the Maria Sharapova part of our conversation, which is to say, you know, we elevate these people, athletes, entertainers, because we need them to function as certain roles in our life. And if anything, they take on shortcuts and they become symbolic and not fully fleshed out as human. And when they try to be human, we punish them endlessly. And I think it's a cruelty. I love the idea. Although I don't know if it was Socrates or Aristotle, but it could have been either, but because it's been a while since I read that essay. But one thing about sport that is so interesting to me is that we really only allow the narratives of the ascension, the sort of dominance, and the downfall, right? And anything else that doesn't fit within our explanation, we punish. And this is certainly the same for celebrity, right? Like if you look at the world of tennis, you know, when Roger Federer decides to take time off because he's generally beloved, it becomes like, oh, this is such a wise move by a seasoned player. He's taking time off to take care of his body so he can really give his all when he comes back. Whereas, you know, when Nadal takes time off, the questions about, is he doping? What's his sort of like, is he trying to cheat the tests? Or Serena Williams takes time off and it becomes about her dedication to the sport or lack thereof. So we really have a few binary positions we allow these folks to be. And I think Zadie Smith does a really good job writing from a place of empathy about human beings, which is why she writes characters in her fiction that I feel like are so extraordinary. When she dabbles in nonfiction, which is why I picked Fences, A Brexit Diary, she does something so rare as an author, which is both create character studies that feel completely real, which is why these characters are three-dimensional, but she also operates in a meta landscape, like with Brexit, and I would argue sort of a precursor to our own political calamity that is currently still unfolding here in the States, with such clear-eyed insight, because she really tries to think at that level of community, nationality, identity, you know, and I'm sort of generalizing, but I like the fact that she's able to work on those two levels simultaneously, which is to me just such masterful writing and thinking.
Yeah. By the way, I've looked it up. It's not Socrates or Aristotle. It's a Jewish guy called Martin Buber, who honestly, that's our philosopher who no one has ever heard of. I mean, to be fair, I'm generous in correcting that because no one was going to get in touch about that.
Just on Fence to Brexit Diary, Caitlin, just tell us what Zadie Smith says in this essay. Like, what's she writing?
I think what I liked about this essay very much is we were thinking a lot about Andy Murray at the time and how convenient or inconvenient his identity as a, well, he's never been an Englishman, has he? But he's been a...
He's been British when he wins and Scottish when he loses.
Exactly. And I think that there's something so profound about this idea of communal understanding, collective understanding, because nations, or I would argue figureheads in sport, really require collective agreement on what the symbols and what the sort of parameters of that membership require. And I think, you know, just generalizing, because I know we still have a lot to cover, I love the fact that she is so, she lays bare her torment over the fact that the nation is splitting and people cannot agree on a collective idea of what the UK is. And in our world, what I like so much about that is tennis is one of the few sports, really outside the Olympics, where a player's nationality and their flag appears next to their name when they're playing. And there's such an overlap between national identity and player and playing style and the narratives we allow people to exist within. So again, I know I'm sort of being general, but I love the fact that Zadie Smith basically talks about collective thinking, her ideas about how we as a society all collectively sort of come together to deride or uplift certain ideas or ideas about nationality, I find endlessly relevant. And it really speaks to the sport. And I say this because at the time that I read this, I was really trying to chase her down to write about Andy Murray, which she still hasn't, but I know she's a tennis fan. So I'm going to sort of leave it there only to say, Zadie, if you're listening, the offer's still on the table. We'll take your writing any time of the day, any week, any time.
So the piece, obviously, like, it has a go at these mad radicals who led Brexit. She calls the Conservative Party the arsonist party, which I think is perfectly accurate. But she does also kind of blame herself and blame middle class complacency on all of this. And the fact that it begins like fences. The reference is a fence that goes up around a local primary school that's suddenly being rated slightly better than it ever has in the past. So there are fences going up all across England. So you're turning yourself away from the city within which you live, and then the country within which you live, and then ultimately the whole country turns itself against the rest of Europe. Are there any other ways in which you can apply this to tennis, Caitlin?
Yes, I think great sports writing or great sports sort of... Again, what a country's boundary, a community's boundary, a particular athlete for whom we find sympathy or to whom we can relate, are all in our imaginations. None of it's real. We don't experience a border when we cross from England into Wales or. You know, it's all sort of, I'm struggling to sort of describe, I think, what is most profound to me about it, except the idea that this idea of universality. And I think, you know, the reason I like this, her body of work generally, but especially Fences, is because she's so, sport offered us a way out of this. And yet when we... And yet we're having a moment of, I think, sheer tribalism in a way that I would hope sport would make the struggles so human and at such a small scale, sort of, you know, you watch Andy Murray lose his 5-set heartbreaker comeback match at the Australian Open and tearfully sort of give a hint that he's going to retire. And you are gutted whether you live in Brazil or the Netherlands or wherever, because you're seeing a human being hit in real time their limits. And I think sport to me is so captivating because it allows for us to sort of outside of our own bodies experience these highs and lows vicariously through sort of other beings. And put in the context of fences, I think what I am so sort of saddened by, but at the same time, I feel like is so accurate, is just, again, this idea of sport allows us to dream together. It allows us to watch and relate both to the person who's in the arena, but also to each other. And what I find so heartbreaking and accurate about Brexit, again, having read this piece, Fences, on the precipice of our own extremely destructive, divisive, and ongoingly, you know, horrible political conversation here in the States, is what happens when you stop dreaming together and you start, and you, as you just read, close off the fences around our schools, our neighborhoods, and essentially our hearts to each other. And it's really this turning away from empathy and this turning away from the other that I think at its best sport invites us to shed. And I think that's why those two pieces sort of exist, or those two ideas exist so strongly in my mind, because sport is so universal. And these political sort of calamities of both of our landscapes have done the easier thing, which is to be small-minded and push away something that doesn't feel comfortable. I'm not explaining this super, super well, but this is certainly one of my more esoteric picks. And again, it was sort of an excuse that I can get, and, you know, like I said, Zadie Smith to agree to write about Andy Murray one day, which I hope she will do, because I think these two ways to relate are really closely, you know, related to each other.
Yeah, that collective experience of sport. There's an old Argentina football manager, Cesar Menotti, who won the World Cup in 78. He said football, it's kind of become a little bit hokey now, but football is a universal language that we speak with different accents, which is a good way of summing up, I think, the collective power of sport. We're going to go from Argentina to Germany and to Werner Herzog. This listener offers his chance to briefly pause. I want to play a clip purely because I've been waiting nearly 50 odd episodes of this podcast to play it. Werner Herzog is a German film director. Here he is talking about chickens.
The enormity of their flat brain, the enormity of their stupidity is just overwhelming. You have to do yourself a favor when you're out in the countryside and you see chicken. Try to look a chicken in the eye with great intensity. And the intensity of stupidity that is looking back at you is just amazing. By the way, it's very easy to hypnotize a chicken. They're very prone to hypnosis. And in one or two films, I've actually shown that.
What does that clip about Werner Herzog talking about chickens tell us about Werner Herzog?
I love how he looks into nature and doesn't see beauty, he sees horror. In the case of chickens, they're cannibalistic. The immensity of their stupidity, and if you've ever heard him talk about our place in the universe and how it is utterly indifferent to human life, gives you some idea about Werner Herzog's sort of philosophical leanings, which I find endlessly fascinating, as I'm sure you guessed.
So he hypnotized a chicken for a movie called Heart of Glass from the 1970s. Now, I, like most people, discovered Werner Herzog in college and then found the most pretentious looking Herzog movie I could find. And we watched it in our house, and it was this like it's called Heart of Glass. We watched it. The shtick was he had hypnotized everyone on screen. It's based in this sleepy village at the foot of the Alps somewhere in Switzerland. Hypnotized a chicken, hypnotizes all the villagers. Nothing really happens. Obviously, the screen went blank at the end, and me and all my pretentious college friends like, oh yeah, really interesting. Yeah, interesting what he did with, you know, the hypnosis and the chicken. And, you know, if you're looking back with it now, obviously, like, what a crock of shit we were talking. Like, it was deeply, deeply boring. But there are obviously better Herzog works out there. Obviously, most people will know Fitzcarraldo. And other people will know him from his kind of Hollywood popcorn work, you know, with Jack Reacher, and has turned up in The Simpsons and in Rick and Morty and so on. But the piece you've picked related to Herzog is an interview you did with the New York Times earlier this year. Tell us a little bit about what's in here.
I liked it because it kind of connected the dots between the Fitzcarraldo sort of, however you first encountered Werner Herzog. For me, it was in the early 2000s with a series of documentaries that he made, because he kind of goes back and forth between, you know, massive, epic, sort of hours-long films to acting, as you just noted, in sort of popcorn and pop culture moments. He was in The Mandalorian this year, which was a big hit and obviously related to the sort of the Star Wars universe, and these sort of very increasingly personal documentary films. And what I like about this interview is it kind of runs the gamut between all of his sort of the narrative thread that runs through them. Because again, we are used to seeing a thinker or an entertainer or a, I would call him a philosopher, really operate with a lot of capacity or competence within one specific arena. And what's so interesting to me about him is he's all over the place. And as such, he seems to have developed this like universal idea about the world and about life and about wildlife. You know, he looks into the souls of chickens and finds them utterly lacking and utterly stupid to such a degree that it's almost nihilism. One of the my favorite films that he made was a film called Grizzly Man, which was about a man called Timothy Treadwell who goes into the wilds of Alaska attempting to document the mating and hibernation and sort of daily routines of grizzly bears. And of course, ultimately ends up getting eaten. And the best part of the film is when Werner Herzog himself appears at the end of the film and listens to the tape of him being eaten while on camera and turns to the, you know, widowed girlfriend and says, "You must burn this tape. You must never listen to this tape." And it's just sort of, I mean, he's so interested in, as I referenced earlier, this idea of ecstatic truth. And he's interested in life as this extremely sort of oppositional exercise. You kind of feel like making a film like Fitzcarraldo, where he literally had a giant steamship disassembled, brought over a mountain range in South America on the back of like pack mules, and then reassembled in the Amazon, where like crew members are succumbing left and right to malaria. There's wild animals. Klaus Kinski's involved, and he's, you know, a despicable person. You start to get a sense, you know, in this interview, Werner Herzog talks about walking from Munich to Paris, I think, or at least, you know, days, if not weeks on foot, basically to keep the spirit of his mentor alive. You get the sense that this is a person who's decided life means something a little bit different than what it does to the most of us. It's not an accumulation of glory. It's not an accumulation of victories or an attempt to keep fears at bay. If anything, it's this trial that he's sort of involved in. And instead of deciding that's negative in some weird way and the universe's indifference to us and the deep stupidity of these animals, which we are lucky enough not to possess, means we should embrace life in some weird sort of kind of actually open-hearted way. And so people find Werner Herzog dour or serious or strange, and he is all of those things, but I find him free of fear. And he kind of addresses that in this piece a little bit. And when he's asked by David Marchese, who's a very good interviewer, if he has doubts or fears or regrets, and essentially he says, you know, absolutely not. I don't live with fear. And to relate that in the sporting sense or some of the senses of writers or authors or thinkers, I personally find really attractive. And I don't want to give myself too much credit, but, you know, again, starting a magazine and doing something very different that wasn't essentially established within our sport or certainly our landscape, required a certain absence of fear. And I think for me, that's the most compelling storyline. Those are the most compelling thinkers. And those are really, truly the most inspiring people that I'm around, the people who don't have fear. If you were to ask me my favorite tennis players right now, or of all time, it would be these players who are sort of gonzo and not always the most successful, but the ones who just kind of barrel forward into life in this way that is sort of undeniable, because it makes me feel alive. And so, again, not to be too highfalutin or certainly self-congratulatory, but when I read people like Werner Herzog, or when I watch a tennis match that feels really inspiring, I'm thinking maybe the 2011 French Open final between Francesca Schiavone and Sam Stosur, for example, an Italian journeywoman tennis player who hadn't been to a Grand Slam final before, but somehow summons the ability to just play without fear and a level of courage and joy that is truly something that I still hold with me as being utterly inspiring. Werner Herzog kind of gets to this, you know, he references being shot in the middle of an interview, and he just keeps talking. And you can see a video of this interview, by the way, which I looked up after I read about it in this interview. You know, and you just sort of think like, okay, well, whatever Werner Herzog is doing with his life, however he is living his life, I certainly want to live my life that way.
That's exactly it. Because that's the piece I've picked out from this. Like, it's written in Q&A format, and I had scribbled in the margins, I wish my life was like this. Question, did you ever find out who shot you? I was shot at various times. Do you mean here in Los Angeles? Yes. No, I wasn't interested. Question, when you pulled Joaquin Phoenix from a car accident, did you know it was him? Yes, although he was upside down in this car, squished between airbags that had deployed and wildly trying to light a cigarette. And he ultimately didn't want Joaquin Phoenix to talk to him afterwards, which just drove off. The guy is actually fantastic. I don't have a clue what to think of him, but I think maybe like we've talked a lot so far about people who we have a very rigid idea of. I think maybe I like Herzog because I have no idea what to think about this guy.
Yeah. I mean, I think so far, if you were to sort of sum up the writers or thinkers that I am inspired by personally, you know, Zadie Smith, we talked about David Foster Wallace. There's a couple others that I wrote down on my list that I find really sort of wildly inspiring. I think because my role at Racquet has to do more with big ideas and, you know, commissioning and creating conversations anew with creators who we haven't really worked with before. That's really how I break down my work with David, who works a lot more closely with our sort of more regular team, where I'm kind of taking more big cuts or going for big names or sort of more conceptual stuff. That's what I find really exciting. And I find reading and reaching out to thinkers and people who kind of have big, bold things to say about the world is endlessly inspiring to me. And I think David Foster Wallace does it one way. I think Zadie Smith does it another way. Werner Herzog is not at all similar. But if you can find a through line in all three of these sort of thinkers, it's that they don't feel particularly constrained by any one mode. And they're all sort of wildly ambitious in a way. And I think maybe each of them could be sort of constrained by fears, although I don't know that Werner Herzog is at all. But I like the fact that they haven't let that stop them from making some sort of big, bold, splashy attempt, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's, to me, super, super cool.
We are sadly slightly constrained by time instead, Caitlin, but I am going to throw a couple of listener questions at you. All tennis based. Richard Hogan asks, and it's a question I was going to ask anyway, how is Djokovic viewed by his peers? Is he liked, disliked? He's had an interesting 12 months. I would venture that he seems to be extremely disliked, but maybe you can correct me.
I think that is a very UK-centric viewpoint. The animosity between, I don't want to generalize because I think the differences between the Scottish fan base, the Irish fan base, the Welsh fan base, the British fan base are probably quite distinct. But I think generally speaking, Djokovic is hated among most of Western Europe generally. And by that, I am including the UK, and I would include the US. Outside of that, the Eastern Europeans, the Indians love him. I can't speak to whether he's liked internally, although I suspect he isn't. The outpouring of support for Rafa Nadal after winning a record 13 Grand Slams the other day seemed in slight contrast to what Novak experienced when he won the Australian Open this year. Again, it wasn't a record, but I do think that there's a little bit of animosity there. I also think Novak plays very much like an Eastern European, right? Like he has this sort of aggrieved sense of a chip on his shoulder. I think he acts like he is he doesn't feel like he has to be a diplomat, maybe because he feels like he's fighting for scraps. And I'm going to generalize greatly and say based on my understanding of Serbian culture, which is limited but not non-existent, I think there's a real persecution complex that even while you're bullying someone else, and I think you could look at the Balkan War and the Bosnians and certainly the Croats as a recent example of the Serbs bullying other people, they still have an internalized monologue. And this speaks to Zadie Smith a little bit. What is your collective identity? And I would say for the Serbs, it's the collective identity of being everyone else's dog and feeling kicked for millennia. Whether or not that's true and whether or not that reflects the way you then should treat other people is kind of irrelevant, because I think if you watch Novak Djokovic behave through that lens, everything makes sense. And so, no, I don't think he's really well liked, certainly among Westerners, but I think anybody who identifies with that feeling of being subservient or not being given the respect they are due. And I think his behavior and the way he comports himself and certainly his fan base starts to make a little bit more sense.
One final question, Caitlin, from Pippo. With Nadal and Federer now both on 20, how much does the fact that 13 of Nadal's Grand Slams just came in at the French Open, does that play a part in who is the greatest player, or can they be split?
I'm going to say the greatest player is neither of them. It's probably Serena Williams, if you're going to go by the count of Grand Slams. However, I choose not to count Grand Slams because I think that it is very arbitrary. And I think actually that's probably one of the greatest things of sport. You could look at Nadal's head-to-head record with Federer and say he's the greatest of all time. They tied for Grand Slams and Nadal has a better head-to-head. Nobody will achieve what he did on clay probably ever. On the other hand, Martina Navratilova won the most titles altogether, mixed doubles, doubles, singles. Is she the greatest of all time? Clay court record, nobody came close to Chris Evert. She won a record, and I think 86% of all matches of all time. Nadal's not close to that. So for me, one of the great things about sport is there's infinitely many ways to parse and to find a narrative for our favorites. All I can tell anybody who likes having this conversation, and sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, but I'm always appreciative of the enthusiasm that prompts the question. And the second thing I would say is the greatest of all time for me is the player or players who make me feel like I'm alive. And sometimes that's every one of the players we just mentioned, and sometimes it's the underdog you've never heard of.
Caitlin, that was a hell of a chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Yeah, thanks a lot to Caitlin. Hope you enjoyed that. It was probably a slightly more abstract than most of our conversations. So do get in touch and let me know how you found it. Email behindthelines@the42.ie. Tweet me at gcooney93. Or as I said earlier on, you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. Thank you once again for your support of this show and the 42 at large. It really is greatly appreciated. It allows us to keep the lights on here at Behind the Lines. And we will be back next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.